Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black discusses post-reunification German politics with The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, and asks whether the changes of government between the SPD and CDU recast the country's political certainties or perpetuated them.
Last week we focused on German unification, and looking over the last now over 3 decades, it's terribly easy to just rush through it and say it's all in the aftermath of unification and make a few comments about economic growth and the challenges at the end of, and subsequent to the age of Merkel. I think what we need to do is slow it down a bit, because if you slow down German history over the last 3 decades, you can see that even in a country which had now it's in its 4th administration, but for most of that period, just 3 administrations, one of which had begun considerably beforehand. Nevertheless, there were important changes in direction, some of which are of interest, not just for German history, but more generally for the challenges facing other European countries. So at the risk of boring some people who want it all rushed up and summarised, I'm going to go through it quite slowly, focus on the politics, and what I'm going to try and do is look at the politics and the economics, and then finish this next week, and then have one session in which what we do is look for long-term continuities and changes. And I make that point, continuities and changes, because lazy historians writing national histories, and there've been no shortage of them in recent years, including of Germany, often search for continuities, more particularly trying to locate them in issues that are supposedly to do with a particular geographical environment or a culture or a unique path of development based on sort of politics more generally. What in Germany they call the Sonderweg. What I'm going to suggest is that actually, repeatedly, you have paths not taken and unpredictabilities. So let's start off. Kohl, as it were, reaped the political benefit in the short term of unification and got himself re-elected in 1994. But he then ran out of steam, not exactly the first leader in a country to do so in the last 30 years, facing rising unemployment. People always tend to think of the German miracle, but in 1998, Germany had 9.4% unemployment. Now, a lot of that, of course, was to do with the failings of the communist system, but nevertheless, 9.8 is a lot of people. And he lost the chancellorship to the SPD candidate, Gerhard Schröder, in 1998. Gerhard Schröder, of course, is still around as kind of Mr. Putin's man in German politics, but in 1998 he was masquerading as a German politician. The SPD saw its percentage rise to 40.9%. Interesting there, because it's worth bearing in mind that in Germany, as in Britain, you're looking at political parties that on the whole do not win an absolute majority. But in the German case, of course, there is the possibility of a coalition. The constituency results are also interesting because what you see is the continuance of a factor that is notable for German history, but nevertheless with variations. And again, there's a parallel with Britain, and that is geographical variations in electoral support. Now, as you will be aware, Graham, we've had a lot of discussion in and since 2019 about the Red Wall and these seats that have changed configuration. And to a degree, you see that in German cases, but there are also aspects of continuity. So if you look at 98, the CDU was dominant in the south, it was dominant in Saxony, and it was dominant in the Catholic Northwest, with the SPD taking most of the rest of the country. And what's interesting about that is the strength of religious configuration in modern Germany as being linked to electoral trends. Now, being linked to electoral trends doesn't mean that they determine them. I think that's a very important point, but they are part of the equation. And again, it's interesting and instructive to think of the contrast here in terms of domestic politics with Spain, or with Britain, or with France, in which religion isn't comparably playing a role. So an SPD Greens coalition was founded, and that was the first solely central left government of the United Germany. And it's interesting that the SPD allied with the Greens, who'd won 6.7% and come third, rather than the Federal Democrats, the FDP, that had cut 6.2%. The Greens achieved more of an impact, I think it's fair to say, helped, of course, by the proportional representation, than was the case in Britain. Now, there was no question of Schroeder completely rejecting the policy of the previous government. There was going to be no attempt at one nation reflation as Mitterrand sought to do in France in 1981. And you could argue that somewhat differently, British governments have been trying to do more recently. Instead of which, Schroeder stood as a pragmatist, keen on labour and welfare reforms. That lost him left-wing support. It had parallels with Tony Blair. Schroeder wasn't as charismatic as Tony Blair. I mean, I happen to think Tony Blair was a different form of spiff, but one has to be realistic here. Schroeder was more electorally questionable, but nevertheless, he managed to win re-election, even if very narrowly, by 2002. Now, it's interesting to look at why Schroeder, which is just 20 years ago, won this re-election. First of all, foreign policy played a role. We tend to think that foreign policy only seems to have come up with Ukraine. Actually, it played a role in West German politics, and once there was the United Country, it played a role in German foreign politics. In particular, Schroeder's opposition to the Anglo-American policy over Iraq won him support, particularly in the former East Germany. Moreover, his opponent, Edmund Stoiber, was a Bavarian Catholic, and that helped to jeopardize his support outside Bavaria. Similarly, the same thing had happened in 1980 when a Bavarian, Franz Josef Strauss, had failed as chancellor. The CDU was also hit in 2002 by a funding scandal over illegal practices, and this led to the disgracing of Kohl. It needs to be borne in mind that corruption was not just endemic in Mediterranean polities, particularly Italy and France in this period, but also to a considerable extent in Spain. There was also large-scale corruption in the CDU in Germany, and Kohl sort of, as it were, was the focus of that. And I think that's important because many British commentators on the European Union tend to underplay that aspect of its politics. It's not a reason for or against Brexit or Remain. There are many other reasons to discuss, both pro and contrary, but it is an aspect of a difference in political culture. Anyway, if in 2002 the Social Democrats and Green Coalition was re-elected, they still had 4.7 million unemployed. And that helped to cause a new crisis for the government. And it led in particular to the Social Democrats losing control of North Rhine-Westphalia, its key electoral stronghold. And the CDU became the foremost party in the federal elections held in 2005. They won only 35.2% of the vote compared to 34.2% for the SDP, But what that led to was that the CDU came into government, albeit with a grand coalition with the Social Democrats. And Angela Merkel, the CDU leader, was elected chancellor in November 2005. Now, we can look at that in several different ways. And again, parallels are interesting here with Britain. I think it's fair to say that in 2010, of course, we had a coalition government elected, that of the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, but there was no suggestion of a Conservative Labour government. And I think the contrast between Germany and Britain then is quite instructive and is quite interesting, as is the contrast between Germany and France. Merkel herself, who was the daughter of a Protestant cleric brought up in East Germany, was a CDU leader who was increasingly disassociated from its Catholic tradition. Now, many CDU members remained Catholics, but the CDU was, as it were, offering a very different position, a very different posture to when Stoiber had stood. Now, there are several ways of looking at that. You could call it, if you like, a Christian democracy with a human face, if you want to use that term, and the implication being that in some way reform and moderation of that type was more appropriate and more attractive, and you can then talk to comparisons with a kind of Cameroonian Toryism. I mean, I think this kind of comment looks less happy now from the perspective of 2022, when Angela Merkel appears to many to have been an unsuccessful and failed leader, and when David Cameron has been associated with at best incompetence and possibly for many people a lack of probity. So I think the situation looks very different, but it's worth bearing in mind that the Germans had that option in the 2005. At the same time, that grand coalition was itself a response to the growing strength of the far left, and that to a degree caused an earthquake in the political system. Now, in the previous election, the former East German Socialist Unity Party, now called the Party of Democratic Socialism, it's hilarious how they organize these names around the place, had won only 5.1%. But now it was getting much stronger. In 2007, indeed, Die Linke, the left party, was formed by an alliance of the previous Eastern one and with the West German left-wing party. And the strength of this party and the its ability of itself to establish Germany as a federal system, to establish itself in four of the West German state parliaments, helped to create tensions within German politics. And again, we tend not to see that today. The standard narrative that is presented in Britain and by commentators more generally is that the German political system is under threat and challenge by the far right, who are referred to as populists and are grouped together variously by people as with Marine Le Pen's Popular Front, as it were, sorry, National Front, by got that one wrong, I'm a bit tired, by Marine Le Pen's National Front in France, by Vox in Spain, by a variety of parties in Italy, by UKIP in Britain, etc., etc. It is worth bearing in mind that actually in Germany, what was starting to trouble some commentators by the mid-2000s was the possibility, I mean, they could get alarmist here, but the possibility that there was going to be a kind of development of the two radical political movements, each in their way populist, if you wish to use that term, that had been seen in the 1920s during Weimar. There were, of course, several issues here. First of all, There were economic problems. There's no two ways about that. The early 2000s were troubling for the global economy as a whole, and Germany was hit by that, not least because its public finances was also bearing the burden of East Germany, which for the West Germans was a much greater burden than the English have to bear in shoving money down the throats of the Scots, the Welsh, and the Northern Irish. The more generally, Germany's federal system created far too many important state elections, voting in which provided opportunities to create a sense of crisis. Although more positively, there was no equivalent to the strains created by devolved assemblies in the UK, and no equivalent to either Catalan separatism in Spain or Scottish separatism in Britain. German politicians certainly spent too much time campaigning and watching the opinion polls and not enough on long-term policy planning. And I think, you know, every period you can worry about the calibre of politics, but I don't think the calibre in the politics of the 2000s and the 2010s of politicians like Schroeder and Merkel was really particularly high. I think Schmidt had been a much more able politician. And again, you can ask yourself questions in the British case about the caliber of politicians in the 2000s and 2010s in Britain, and say that once you create a powerful state, you actually do have a need for efficient and effective and forward-looking and thoughtful politicians, and we've not always managed that. In the German case, it reflected a failure of leadership that was also seen in other aspects of German policy, particularly an unwillingness to maintain defence preparations, and that was from the wealthiest and most populous of European states, most populous west of Russia, let alone to use force in NATO or EU missions. And it could be argued that this was a negligence, that this negligence was to contribute directly to President Putin's expansionism and threatening posture, and that although it's obviously appropriate to focus on Angela Merkel's failures, which were multiple in this field, that much actually was already in play during the previous administrations. And I think that that is a rather interesting thing. It creates, of course, a slightly contradictory response from other European states. So you get states like Italy or Greece and Poland, in which politicians reflect or a kind of fear of, or a stated fear of, German hegemony, notably within the EU and in particular in fiscal and economic affairs, but also a concern that Germany did not make appropriate use of its power and position. I think it's worth bearing in mind that the Germans seem to have bought so heavily into the idea of soft power, of using the EU as an opportunity to expand the federalism practiced in Germany. And they didn't really think through adequately broader questions of disagreements and difficulties in the wider world. We'll take a pause in a second, but one last point I want to make is we've been talking a bit about the problems posed by the rise of the far left, but also, as I've mentioned, there was a far right political identity and activism, particularly but not only in the former East Germany, and particularly but not only in the former East Germany in the area of Saxony-Anhalt, that land. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that it can be a mistake. We all do this when we're cutting corners or only have so much time. I make the mistake occasionally of referring simply to East Germany as if it was the former East Germany, as if it was some monolith. I mentioned last time, of course, the contrasts between the area of Saxony and the area of Brandenburg in the late 80s, and it's worth bearing in mind that that continued to be the case. Anyway, there was a, I mean, in a way, it was ironic. East Germans had benefited economically from unification, but that didn't assuage a strong sense of discontent, a sense that they had been ignored and pushed around the place. And I think it's fair to say that that was a matter which was underplayed, its potential long-term risk was underplayed. And that was part and parcel of this broader failure of political imagination during the Merkel years. Anyway, I've started off there. I've gone quite rapidly through the politics of the 2000s. I wonder whether, Graham, you'd like to say a few things and then we can move on.
Yes, I would. Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. And I'd like to start with the political party, political focus that you've brought to this discussion. You mentioned early on that, you know, the first federal elections after reunification, Helmut Kohl was rewarded, his CDU was rewarded with a victory. And it wasn't until 1998 that an SPD-led government was formed. I'm wondering what influence the absorption of the former East Germany into the Federal Republic. I'm wondering to what extent that created a larger reservoir of support for left-wing groups, particularly the you know, centre-left SPD. Should we see that unification is actually over the longer term moving the centre point of German politics towards the left? Or in that case, how do we explain the long spell in office of Angela Merkel?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question there. I think that, I think what I would say is to just reprise the point I've made, that East Germany was not a single monolith. And I mean, East Germany, for example, was the centre of Pegida, the patriotic Europeans against the Islamicization of the Occident, or the fact which was founded in Dresden in 2014. And I scarcely think that matches the agenda of the, at least formally, of the left, though, as we know, the left can be every bit as racist and sexist as everybody else. What I would say is that the admission of East Germany, which had not got a grounded capitalist system, encouraged a dependency on federal funds, and that itself inherently encourages either what you might call the left or conservatives who are willing to open the spigots, the taps, and pour vast amounts of money accordingly. And I would put Angela Merkel in the latter category. I mean, one could ask a big question as to whether she was a conservative any more than whether, shall we say, David Cameron or Boris Johnson were conservatives. And that reminds us that conservatism, like the left, has, you know, it's a mansion with many houses, or rather a broken down house with many, many gaping windows. But I think the point nevertheless arises. So what I would say is that the circumstances of unification with the large scale subsidies to East Germany, former East Germany, did affect the discussion of politics. That didn't inherently mean a benefit necessarily for the left, the formal parties of the left, but it did encourage a sense of the need for state intervention. And some of the stuff was quite impressive. I mean, I took the train in July from Frankfurt to Berlin on the new line that was pushed through Thuringia. And, you know, it's a very impressive service. And we had abject apologies because we were running, I think, 2 minutes late. I mean, could you imagine, you know, from a British perspective, the whole thing was quite astonishing. I think that the money situation was an important one, and that what might have happened but for that is worth considering.
Well, I was very interested in the observation you made about that, you know, despite the tensions in post-reunification Germany, I mean, particularly the tension between the former East Germany, who feel, you know, they're Western carpetbaggers coming in, and likewise former West Germans feeling that East Germany is a drain on their taxes. But you know, there's no real spirit of separatism, whereas, you know, you have the Catalans in Spain, the Scottish Nashers, Welsh Nashers, so on. That lack of separatism, do we put that down to a simple legal explanation, which is separatism is as I understand it, illegal under the German constitution. So in a way, it's a non-starter. Or is it more just that, you know, whatever their political differences, everyone within the borders of Germany is German, and therefore a form of separatism seems different compared to, let's say, Catalans or Scottish nationalists who feel they're different to the majority within their country?
Well, I think that's fascinating. I mean, if you're looking at what you might call the equivalent of Scottish or Catalan feeling, I would say it's more encapsulated in a rather different thing, which is anti-immigrant politics. I think that it's worth bearing in mind that the East Germans were really demographically smashed over the head in the unification crisis. So, I've got the figures here. 538,000 East Germans moved into West Germany in 1989 to 90. The birth rate in East Germany fell from 200,000 in 1989 to 115,000 in 1991. And I think it's fair to say that East Germany was a lot of its people of talent and ability. Now, the situation is rather different in, shall we say, Catalonia, where, you know, there are very many able Catalans who live in Catalonia and don't wish to be spending their time supporting what they see as very different cultures in Castile or Andalusia, and certainly less prosperous ones. But you're right, there was no real separatist movement, and that in part reflected the particular developments in 1990, and specifically the failure electorally and in terms of offering a fiscally plausible policy of those who had wanted a kind of federal solution between the former East Germany and the former West Germany. So I think it's quite interesting there. You can go to East Germany now. I was there this year, and I was there, former East Germany, and I was there in 2019 last. And if you do so and you talk to people, you will find that many of them have a kind of anti-national government, anti-Berlin attitude, but they are talking more about a wish to conduct their affairs in their land, or even more their locality, as they want, not a wish for independence. And I think that's quite a significant contrast and difference. Of course, were Germany to be a failed economy, the situation might be very much different. Were Germany to be a failed economy with significant demands for compulsory military service, the situation might be different. But that's not the case. And the Germans are also helped by the fact that although there are some singularly unpleasant politicians on the far right and the far left, there isn't the kind of drip of national corrosion and attacking the identity of a culture that you see in Britain with, for example, a combination of endless comments and criticisms of history, of the empire, of supposed rule from London, etc., etc., etc.
And is that in part because there hasn't been the capture of institutions by the progressive left in Germany that there has been in countries like the United States and indeed in Britain, do you think? Or is it just a different history has produced different attitudes?
Well, that's interesting again. Well, first of all, what I know most about are the universities. And as you might know, in the German pattern, here I'm thinking of the pattern based on West Germany, because of course after unification they sacked most of the East German academics and replaced them with West Germans. In the West German pattern, the universities were essentially under the control of the Land, the region, which meant that there were Lands which were on the left and there were Lands that were on the right. Same thing, incidentally, in the archives. And I think it's fair to say that ensured a degree greater cohesion between local government, local communities, and universities than is the pattern in Britain. There are obviously what you might call a capture of the institutions by those on the left, yes. I think it varies depending upon which institutions you are thinking about. And I think also Germany is a more multifaceted society and a more multifaceted political system in some respects than you might imagine if you were living in, shall we say, France or England. I'm talking about England rather than Britain as a whole. So I would actually argue that if you go around Germany and you were to look at the local newspapers, and a lot of these newspapers are very good, we're not talking about rubbish, you will again find newspapers that reflect I had a holiday in, I think it was 2017, on the Bodensee, Lake Constance. And I remember reading the Süddeutsche Zeitung. And, you know, it's very much what you might expect if you were living in that part of the world. It's a good newspaper, but it's very different to what you would anticipate if you were living in some other parts of Germany. And again, I think opinion, in a sense, is to a degree more grounded on regional difference than on political partisanship.
Well, that's a very interesting point. There's something else which is on my mind, and that is the performance of the Greens over the last 20 years or so. You're often partners of the SPD in government, and environmentalism has affected enormously the governing parties, let alone the opposition parties across Western countries. But only, I think, in Germany has the Green Party really amassed very, very high level of votes, much more so than you get in France or Britain, for example. I suppose there are two points to my question. The first is, in a way, in terms of policy, does that matter? Is the German government's green policy any more or less stringent to the Conservative government in Britain? You know, policies seem quite similar in terms of the route to net zero. But secondly, why is it that so much support seems to have gone into the German Green Party and not so much in other Western Green parties?
Well, that's interesting. First of all, you're right. I mean, the Greens went into the Bundestag from 1983 and also became more significant in state politics. And I've already mentioned, you know, that there was an SPD Green coalition in 98, which I think really, you know, was very different to the experience of the Greens elsewhere. And in the 2017 election, the Greens were on 8.9%. Now, you may recall that in the last election, it was initially thought the Greens would do phenomenally well. I mean, the polls at the beginning of 2021 gave the Greens 18%, putting them ahead of the SPD. Well, they didn't achieve the same degree of success, but you're right, they did very well. Why is that? I would say it's because the Greens have been very successful at winning the support, not just of the young and the committed middle class, but also of a wider tranche of middle class and middle-aged opinion, as well as a lot of the young, so that they, in a sense, have benefited whenever the SPD seems tired. And, you know, that's been important because the SPD has found it quite difficult to free itself from, it has done so, but it's found itself difficult to free itself from its trade union heavy industrial background. Has it made much of a difference? Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, as you were aware, Merkel wanted to get rid of nuclear power, and I think it's fairly clear cut that that was very much due to the Greens, of course, you know, directly helpful to Vladimir Putin. And I think, though, that the determination in Germany as a whole to keep industry powerful acts as a constraint. On the other hand, the Germans are interested in this notion of high-skill, high-value manufacturing, and that is presented as a manufacturing that requires and can finance frequent changes in manufacturing procedures, and that those in turn make environmental improvement strongly possible. So I would say that the of the major European countries, by major, I just mean in terms of size, but of the major European countries, Germany has a better opportunity in that direction than France or Spain or Italy or Poland or Britain.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very interesting point you make. I want to pick up on some of the themes we've touched on in this episode next week, not least the nature of German identity, German foreign policy, and Germany's sense of itself embedded within the European Union. I think that's a whole other debate for another day, though. So let's pick up with some of those themes next week. But for talking us through the many of the aspects, the political aspects, particularly of the first 30 years of German reunification, Professor Jeremy Black, the author of A Brief History of Germany, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.